Welcome to The Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you this fine Wednesday afternoon?
Very well, thanks, Nick. How's it?
And Sarah Gahn. Sarah, how are you?
No, I'm well, thank you.
Right, so let's get into our stories for today. And the first one is quite an interesting one because I think it's, you know, it's kind of part of that larger discussion on race in South Africa that's always ongoing and one of the central problems with BEE. So 3 years ago, a Western Cape teacher by the name of Glenn Snyman, who is, I guess, traditionally under apartheid probably would have been classified as colored, applied for a principal's job at a Western Cape school, and he identified himself as African, not colored. Snyman himself is an outspoken critic of race classification, and he founded a group called People Against Race Classifications. He's particularly outspoken against the term, the use of the term colored, which he considers degrading. In 2010, he led a campaign against the government's continued use of race categories, black, colored, Indian, and white, and he asked for people to sign a petition saying, "I don't regard myself as colored, black, Indian, or white. I regard myself as South African." So he applied for this job, and he didn't get it. But 3 years later, he's being taken before a disciplinary commission and charged with fraud by the Western Cape Education Department. And the education department said that he had committed a common law offense to writ fraud by stating on his CV when applying for principal post at the secondary school that he is an African male, whereas his records indicated that he was a colored male, and he was doing so to gain advantage for the purposes of being shortlisted. This caused a bit of a stir online, and the DA Western Cape Education Minister Debbie Schaefer responded to these allegations by saying, "One of the many evils of apartheid was the classification of people by the so-called race. This is what we fought to rid our country of. So I'm understandably shocked to discover that my department is apparently charging someone because of how they chose to classify themselves. If this is in fact the case, it is anathema to me, and I will not tolerate the victimization of people who do not conform to an artificial and arbitrary classification of who they deem to be. I have asked for all the information regarding the case as a matter of urgency because, on the face of it, it does not appear to be in line with what the administration stands for." So I guess I'll ask Gabriel first. And my question about this, there's a number of things one can go at here. And that's, you know, once again, we see this issue where it's not clear what defines someone's race in law, and yet we use it all the time. So this is something that Mr. Snyman here has managed to pick at. But also, it says something, I think, about the DA's Western Cape government, about perhaps that the bureaucracy is not entirely on the same page as the politicians. What do you make of it, Gabriel?
Yeah, no, I think that's it's an important thing to hone in on. The Democratic Alliance is not often spoken of in the same terms as the ANC. No one will be a stranger to the thought that the ANC is an umbrella organization which hosts various factions whose ideas are mutually annihilating. The same is, in fact, true of the DA. And you can see that in the difference between, for example, the DA's policy on race-based law under John Steenhuisen as interim leader and Gwenna Gwenya as policy head, and what was going on before when Musi Maimane was the leader of the party. As a side note, it looks like Musi Maimane is now coming out against BEE himself, which is hilarious given the fact that he wouldn't even allow that to be debated while he was in charge of the DA. But one of the roles that politicians play is symbolic leadership, which means they esteem, they by virtue of their own example, fame, and clout, they set the tone for bureaucrats, administrators, lower level representative politicians to follow. And they have sent mixed messages. And in fact, for quite a few years before 2019, they were sending quite a strong message that race classification is very important, and only by classifying people first and then discriminating on the basis of those classifications politically and economically second, can we achieve social justice. So I think with that legacy, it's no surprise that some bureaucrats within the Western Cape Education Administration are keen to pursue a person who on the face of it looks colored, but it identified himself as African. And as a last note on that, I think, I've identified myself as African too, where that has been an option, because African, when I was a kid and Tom Mbeki made his famous I'm an African speech, he made it clear that the African designation is not one of race, but one of geographical location.
So, Sara, similar questions to you. And will we ever see a time when the law is really forced to confront the fact that, you know, racial classification doesn't exist in the law, and yet it's used everywhere in government policy?
That's an extraordinary thing, because it hasn't been raised. And somebody said to me some years ago that, yes, well, essentially people are using the Population Registration Act classifications, which was the sort of bedrock piece of legislation that the Nats relied on. But while they maybe have been sort of applying them, there was no legal basis for doing so. And this is where the argument very strongly goes against BEE and affirmative action, is that you have to apply some sort of classification in order to discriminate. It's also possible that at the administrative level in the Western Cape, the kind of memo hasn't been read. So the issue has just been taken up and the fraud has been declared and somebody hasn't thought about it. And it could be an issue of great embarrassment. It strikes me that there's a real opportunity here, in the sense that since the gentleman concerned seems to be a fighter for the rights not to be classified and for race classification not to exist, the DA may want to harness his energies in that regard. But they first obviously have to sort out the bureaucratic mess and apologize. But I think Devi Shaff is the sort of person who will get to it quickly and get it resolved quickly, as it should be resolved. And I think it'd be terribly difficult to prove this is fraud, since it relies on self-classification in most instances. So if you classify yourself as African, you may argue with that person, but it's not criminal to do so.
Indeed. Any final thoughts on this topic, Gabriel?
Yeah, I do want to say something that I think is difficult, but probably reasonable people will disagree here, but I think it's important to point out. I think that we can't do without racial classification in South Africa. I think the Institute of Race Relations work, for example, in terms of polling, we make sure that our polls are demographically representative, both across various matrices, and one of those matrices is race. When we lay out our data, sometimes we say X portion of respondents said this, but we, for every question, we'll also lay out what respondent breakdown you have by race. And people, I think, do well to bear in mind that there is a kind of race blindness, which is off-putting to a lot of common sense South Africans, who think, how can you pretend not to know what someone's race is, or not to think that it's a social convention that is reliably understandable most of the time? Which is to say, there are going to be cases where people are hard to classify, but generally it's quite an easy thing to do. And I think that, you know, one needn't be race blind in order to be a non-racialist. The non-racialism of the kind that the DA is now starting to fight for, and for which I think the IRR, this is my interpretation of the core principle of the IRR, that non-racialism is about equality before the law. It says, you know, persons might be free to identify themselves this way and that way, but the law ought not to discriminate for or against, no phobia, no favor, on the basis of that classification. So the classification is one thing. It's the it's what you do with it that really concerns me. So the thought that someone could get promoted to being a principal or not get promoted to being a principal because of how they happen to classify themselves or not about race, that's the real crux of the issue from a legal perspective. And then from a social perspective, there's also this question of, how much can we tolerate a society in which people will grieve for one another or celebrate one another only on the basis of race? I do think that that's at this stage a secondary issue because the law has gone so deep into leveraging racial classification to create division. But I think that that's also why the secondary issue comes to light. I think it's important to drive non-racialism also in that softer sense of, however you might classify yourself, it's very important to identify as a South African and realize that we really are all in this ship together and we're going to sink or float together.
Can I just say that I agree with you, Gabriel, and I think what one's really got to move towards is that classification really is, it's not classification as such. Let's call it classification, is necessary from a statistical point of view to measure a whole lot of matrices that tell you how your society is going, particularly given where we come from. But it should be no more than that. In other words, it's neutral. Yeah. It doesn't favor or disfavor anyone.
Right. No one should be accused of fraud because they're claiming to be black. And I think Mrs. Snyman here has done quite a good job actually in exposing the problems with our whole system here. So probably not in the way he expected, but a good thing nonetheless.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to our
next
story.
Not all heroes wear capes, eh?
Indeed. Not all heroes necessarily intend to be them. Yeah. Right. So we've been talking this week, of course, about the very important piece of legislation, which is the expropriation without compensation legislation, which is coming down the track. Gabriel and I did a podcast on this on Monday. And yesterday, Franz Krenier and Ivor Fechter talked about it on our podcast. But we talked a lot about how the media had responded to this and how it's been fairly – we were a bit disappointed with the way the media had responded to it and how they hadn't seen the proper threats. And unfortunately, it seems as though the media is being joined by AGBIZ. There was a policy brief which went out to various AGBIZ members which saw them claim that expropriation will remain a last option to the extent that it was used. It will – success or failure of other land reform programs based on public-private partnerships, which is government's preferred route at present. Gabriel, are they being naive?
I think that they are. I mean, there's also the alternative that they're being knavish, which is to say they know exactly what they're doing and deliberately misrepresenting the case. But I think naivete is a good place to start. One of the sort of strange aspects of AGBIZ's reading of the bill, and this has been on the table since expropriation without compensation became a major talking point in 2018, is how it looks at the most obvious problem with the bill, which is that it says, here are six circumstances for expropriation without compensation, five of those for private property expropriation without compensation. But this list is not limited. It's including but not limited to these five scenarios. So these are just examples of the kinds of things that you need to look for. Has someone's land been invaded and they've lost control over it? Well, expropriation without compensation. Has someone bought a house or a farm or some asset for 10 and is hoping to sell it for 12? Well, there's a target for expropriation without compensation. But, don't let us stop you there. You keep going and trying to find other places where you may, as the state, as the executive branch of government, consider an asset to be worth expropriating without compensation. Now, AGBIZ is reading from the start under Theo Bosshoff, their sort of legal expert since 2018, has been that we should all really welcome this including but not limited part of the government's proposal, of the legislature's proposal. And the reason they say that is because when you go to court, if you dispute the amount of compensation that's being offered because it's below market value or it's all the way to zero, you can go to court and you can take any number of circumstances to bear on why you think the valuation should be above zero or above whatever's being offered. This is a very strange reading. There's one way to see that is that the bill as it's currently tabled has two clauses, one for how to calculate compensation and one for conditions for expropriation without compensation. In the first, it says, you know, in these circumstances, these are the things you can take into account when considering the value of compensation, including. And it's only in the second one, when it talks about expropriation without compensation, that it says these circumstances, it may be just to have nil compensation, including but not limited to. So both of them are technically open lists, because when you say including at the start of your list, it's like saying including but not limited to. But the emphasis of explicitly saying but not limited to only comes with the expropriation without compensation list. It's not for the general valuation of an expropriation. Firstly, so there's an emphatic problem here. You know, the bill as it stands is emphasizing that the EWC list is incomplete. The second thing is, it could have the EWC list be complete and still satisfy what Theo Boshoff is going after. So he wants, if the government says they want to take your 50 million rand farm and only pay you 10, you want to go back to the court and say, well, there's all these things you haven't considered, like how many staff depend on the business and how unlikely it is for other people to run it in the government, because look at all of this evidence of how you haven't been able to run the farm next door. That's not explicitly listed in the bill, but it matters. You know, I get it. You want people to be able to bring whatever arguments are relevant to the case to the courts in their defense. But that could be achieved by having the wording of the bill say, when considering compensation, here are factors that you must take into account: the market value, the previous use of the land, the current use of the land, and so on. And that list is open so that people can take anything to court that they think is relevant. But here are the conditions where you get EWC, and this list is closed. And it's only these circumstances. And, you know, if it turns out that there's something big that we haven't thought about, then we'll go back to re-legislating. But that would be the only way to get the policy certainty that AGBIS pretends this thing provides. It doesn't provide that policy certainty. And and their argument for why it should keep the list open is spurious. It's not serious, and it's very distracting. That's the first thing. I'll just make two points. The second point is laughable, frankly, which is say the real worry here is that the political left, and I quote, is going to encourage people to believe that the bill allows for expropriation without compensation on a wide scale. And this is going to get the hungry landless people very excited, and the bill can't do that, so it's not going to be answered, and this is going to create political turmoil. In other words, they're anticipating, they know, because I have written about them, I've written to them, they know that the Institute of Race Relations is extremely concerned with their policy of appeasement, whether it's through naivete or knavishness, I'm not sure. I can't know that. But their appeasement policy is not good. And so they've anticipated the criticism by saying only people on the political left are going to depict this bill as allowing for large-scale EWC, when it is anything but true. The real people who are going to try to take advantage of the EWC clause are going to be bankrupt or near bankrupt municipalities who have now figured out you can buy off your debts by giving Eskom land. There's 60 billion rand outstanding in unordered municipal reports. There's 30% of municipalities that are basically bankrupt. The average payment to creditors delay is 180 days. So our municipalities have shown through and through that they will use every opportunity to hold on to wealth and to bully the little guy. They see a clause that say, hey, you may expropriate without compensation any property for these reasons, but also any other reason you can think of. It's going to be taken advantage of. The municipalities are, in a sense, the political left, but they're not the hungry landless. They're bureaucratic elites who are trying to run a patronage network on fumes because the government has run out of money, because the country has run out of money. It's extremely concerning, and I think it's distracting for AGBIS to put the things the way they have, and it's a big problem, because AGBIS is the biggest representative of big farm in South Africa, of big farming enterprises, and they have real clout, but they're not using it, I think, in a productive way.
I think we've seen across civil society and business the track record of appeasing government on these fundamental questions, like, you know, property rights or pretty much anything else of great concern is pretty bad. A lot of the time people, not always, unless you do a deal with government, you can come out okay. But most of the time, you know, you really can get left out in the cold. I mean, the mining industry knows this. They're probably the best example of this. And yet, despite, you know, seeing so many other industries eaten by the line of socialism in front of them, there's like a never-ending supply of people who are willing to sign up to dodgy appeasement deals with the government. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a combination of, I guess, white guilt, and it may not necessarily only be white, but guilt certainly anyway, and the appeal to a social need, and it comes out in this document as well, and it's common throughout the media exposure on this, and that is that this is being presented as a land reform measure, and in the AGBA's document they say they've never been happy about expropriation without compensation as being a path to agricultural development. But they're much more, uncertain when it comes to land reform in the broad sense. Now, the problem is the government's actually been incredibly clever in doing this, because there was nothing to stop the government in the last 26 years from carrying out land reform properly. The fact is it carried out by and large poorly, with lots of corruption and such poor management that land, a few years ago, the land affairs portion of the department was actually put under administration. So the failure to deal with so-called land reform, this act is not going to resolve that. If it doesn't resolve the other issues, it sure as hell is not going to do it through this particular bill. So that's the one thing, but it's been an effective tool because it's been based on a terribly emotive historical issue. And we know from our own research that land reform is actually really at the bottom of most people's needs and desires for what they need to change in their lives or have changed in their lives. And then the second point that I want to make is just this. Whenever a piece of legislation is drafted, and this goes against the naive principle, you've always got to draft legislation bearing in mind the worst that can be done with the legislation. In other words, is Churchill applying the legislation or is Hitler? And you've got to build in safeguards in case the latter occurs. Now, let's be honest. I mean, I can't imagine that there are actually too many people, even if they would support them electorally, who trust the ANC at this point. Now, if they wouldn't trust them now because of the theft, the mismanagement, the poor policies, etc., why should they trust that they will do the right thing in terms of this legislation? The legislation gives them the room not to do the right thing. And that's the point. Not what will or won't happen, but what could possibly happen.
Gabriel, any final thoughts on this topic? 30 seconds.
No, sorry, I said something very good there. Let's be drafted to rein in the worst possible impulses of a rogue executive, not to make maximum room for power abuse.
As one of the American founding fathers said, I think it was, if men were angels, we wouldn't need laws.
Yeah. Exactly.
Anyway, let's move on to our final topic today. And this is, of course, part of, I think, the larger free speech debate. There's been a lot of concern amongst people who use social media a lot, especially of the influence of social media companies on free speech on one hand, and on the other hand, as propagators of false news, fake news, and divisiveness. Now, different social media companies have responded to this fairly differently, but the latest development is that Facebook will be banning any advert which targets users to discourage them from getting vaccines. Facebook Incorporated will start banning ads that explicitly discourage people from getting vaccinated, the world's largest social media company said on Tuesday. It also announced a new flu vaccine information campaign will be used in various countries where the government cooperates. Facebook has, of course, 2.7 billion active users, although it's not growing as it once was. It said that this is part of a larger effort to fight against misinformation regarding COVID-19 and public health. However, Recently, their public policy manager, Jason Hirsch, said the company believed users should be able to express personal anti-vaccine views, and that more aggressive censorship would push people hesitant about vaccines towards the anti-vaccine camp. So it looks like their approach is towards banning people who are actually doing adverts and trying to kind of use Facebook systems, but not towards banning speech. Sara, what do you make of Facebook's approach and this issue in general?
Well, the issue in general is it's either you allow everything, which is a pure free speech scenario, or once you start to make exceptions, you keep on having to make exceptions. So it started off with the sort of woke left demanding that anyone who expressed a view that wasn't theirs of a certain kind would be circumscribed. Then I know recently it's gone on to the platforms used by the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, which are violently anti-Semitic. And while it might be personally satisfying, it is again a curtailment. And then now they've had to, I think one of the platforms has had to deal with the canceling anything that denies the Holocaust. Again, maybe personally satisfying, but again, it's not out there and you can't counter it. You're just narrowing the scope more and more. It always has the, I'm not less concerned about the advertising, because any organization has the right to put on or not whatever advertising it wishes, it can choose to. But views on something really should, personal views on something should not be restricted, but then they shouldn't be restricted on any topic, vaccines or otherwise.
Gabriel, what do you make of this? Do you think Facebook is doing the right approach? What's your kind of, we've seen, I think, you know, I'm actually doing a little bit of research on this at the moment, that in certain circumstances, fake news and kind of dodgy information can be used to pretty negative effect, can amplify negative trends that already exist, like, for example, in Myanmar, where it was used to encourage people to commit genocide. What's your take on Facebook's approach?
Yeah, and in Rwanda. So my feeling is that the famous free speech exception example, which is that if someone gets up in a theater and shouts fire, this is so likely to cause a stampede that'll do harm that you shouldn't be allowed to do it. This is actually a sort of wild example given in a real case during war in America. And I do think that there are real wartime exceptions to freedom of speech clause. I think if you're in a war and someone is spreading lies that are you know, being paid by the enemy to spread lies that are going to help the enemy and harm the war effort, it's just unfair to curtail that. And I think that a pandemic is an extraordinary and temporary circumstance, not unlike war. And so there is a theoretical argument to be made that is consistent with hardcore libertarians like Milton Friedman, that even in such a circumstance, you may be able to curtail free speech. I'm not sure that we are in that kind of pandemic. I'm not sure if we're in that kind of war. I think that's one of the major problems. One of the secondary issues is that the way that people are thinking about the pandemic, at least sort of a lot of political and media elites, is not temporary. They sort of seem to be acting as if so long as there's any flu virus or coronavirus in the world, then the pandemic is ongoing. Long gone are the days of hospitals being totally overwhelmed in the way that they were in Italy and Spain earlier in this year, but still we're expected to think about things in the same way. But the third issue is that, you know, Facebook is not a government platform. And so it does have a private right to pick and choose, as it will. The flip side of that is people have the right to choose whether they want to use Facebook or not. And I think that this argument, when it was first trialed about 5 years ago, sort of started trending, well, just get off Facebook if you don't like their rules, did seem a little bit silly. It still does, to the extent that there aren't mainstream alternatives that have been bought into in a big way by South Africans that offer the same suite of social media services. But that is changing year on year. And I think that it's this kind of behavior which is going to drive customers away from Facebook over a period of years and decades, really. But I think that we'll be in a much healthier situation in 20 years' time when there really are a plurality of social media sites that offer a similar suite of services that allow the market to do work that I think only the market can do. I think only a proper free market can deal with this. They want to make their funny rules, no swearing, no wearing upside down pink hats, no Holocaust denying, from the silly to the very serious. They want to make their rules. You can choose to go somewhere else that has different rules. Right now, it's just not possible because they have a de facto monopoly.
Right. I do think that is quite an important point. The only reason that we do care about what Facebook says is because it is so big. Any final 10-second thoughts from you, Sarah?
No, really, to say I agree about the leveling effect of the free market. And, of course, Facebook is under lots of pressure to unbundle itself because of its sheer size and influence. So I think that's very much going to be what happens. And to some extent, we've got to accept that the social media platforms are operating in an environment that's new. I mean, 20 years odd isn't a long time. And also, particularly, is because none of us could anticipate how it would evolve and be used. But these are going to become financial, economic business decisions for Facebook.
Agreed. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.